Is it treason to say the truth? A bitter truth, but no less true for that.
Welcome to Two Champs and a Chump, a Game of Thrones LCG podcast founded in 2010 by myself, Will Lentz, Brett Zeiler, and Greg Atkinson. Currently regularly hosted by myself, Brett, and Daryl Lloyd. Thanks go out to George R. R. Martin for the world we're all fans of, FFG for this amazing game, Card Game DB for our hosting, and Josh Woodward for the Creative Commons license music that you hear in this episode. This is Season 4.
Yeah. Alistair Florent, baby. People forget he exists.
Hell, I forget he exists.
I know, right? Happens when you're not one of those big names.
Or your card's kind of subpar.
I mean, it's kind of okay, right? I don't know. I tend to get the two Florents mixed up, Alistair and Axel. So, which one's Alistair again? Oh, yeah, he's the new discard one that looks like a stunning, gray-haired, foxy version of myself. Never mind, I love Alistair Florent.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I'll tell you what, with the, you know, the Bera big army recursion-type stuff and with my newfound love of Blackwater Bay, like, that Alistair Florent gets a little sexier.
You know who else gets sexier?
Who?
You know, I'm not sure. It just sounds a little too conceited if I say myself. And the Two Champs and a Chump podcast, episode 149, isn't really a who. It's more of a what.
I see what you're getting
but
at.
But it does tend to get sexier.
But maybe, just maybe, it's this host, Daryl Lloyd.
Ah, yes.
I'm going to highly doubt that. I'm going to tell you right now, Daryl, that you may get drunker, but you don't get hotter.
Ah, but Kyle, as you get drunker, he does get hotter.
That I will not deny. I will not deny.
That's right. My jokes get funnier, too.
You're almost humorous by the end of the podcast. That is...
Almost.
I chuckle to myself quietly.
To yourself.
You chuckle to yourself while listening to the podcast that you're on?
I mute the mic. I don't want to get conceited.
Oh, yeah.
Good man. Don't want to go straight to his head. Well, along with Daryl, I'm Will, also known as Kenan.
And I guess I'm still Kyle?
Yeah, I don't think we've traded you in for anybody else yet.
Not yet.
To the disappointment of many listeners, I'm sure.
Bless their hearts.
Yeah.
Mainly my fiance. She says I'm often the worst person on here.
Really? Wow.
Well, I think it's because really she can yell at me. Up. She listens to it while we clean, and she's like, God, Kyle. She's like, you sound like a dick. Also, you're not putting the dishes away right. And I'm like, that's a 1-2 punch of bullshit I'm just not ready for.
You know, I think maybe the cleaning is just kind of coloring her perception. You know, if you were doing something else like having a nice dinner and a glass of wine, maybe that would change her perception of the podcast.
Because I love to woo and romance my woman over me talking about Thrones and Daryl's dick jokes.
That's right. That's what the ladies love.
That takes us to Happy Town every time.
I know.
I mean,
I really... There's no punchline to that. I know. That's what they love.
Aw, yeah.
But I do know that this is a great podcast, and thank you for tuning in to another wonderful, sensual episode of Two Champs and a Chump. We've got a great show for you today.
Yes, we do. No interesting FFG news this week, which is kind of a bummer. But, you know, I suppose that's bound to happen as we enter this dry period and wait on the next chapter pack, which is a real bummer.
I have some exciting news.
Do tell.
With this being episode 149, 149 is a prime number. So this will be the first prime number we have had in quite some time.
Really? What would have been...
Actually, only like 10 episodes.
Yeah.
But still, that's like 3 months.
Speaking of, I think maybe I'll take this moment, since we're on episode numbers anyway, to bump this from the end during Props and Slops and give it a little primetime slot. Listeners may remember a few weeks ago we commented that we were coming up on episode 150 and how we wanted to do something special, and we were trying to schedule a time for a live recording, do kind of an Ask Me Anything type thing with Google Hangouts, and we have settled on a time and place for that. So that will be Sunday, March 2nd, after the Moon Boy Classic at about 12:30 or so Central Time. That'd be GMT minus 6 for anybody not as familiar with the U.S. time zones, which I think will be a relatively good time to get folks on. There's not too much going on early Sunday afternoons for a lot of folks. So we're gonna meet up in person at Metagames Unlimited, where the tournament's being held the day before, and kind of recap how things went and answer some questions.
Yep, just hanging out.
It's real excited. It's gonna be a great drive down, great tournament. I'm probably gonna be a little buzzed for that.
Yeah. Speaking of rides down and such, that's worth pointing out for people then that there will not be an episode of the show going up on Friday the 28th of February. Since we normally record early in the week, then post that Friday, but we were trying to finagle 150 to record on the weekend, and when Kyle's down so we can do it in person and have it right after the tournament so we have more to talk about and whatnot. I want to warn listeners up front, no new episode next Friday.
Yep. We haven't forgotten about
yeah.
you.
That way I can cut Aaron Glazer off right now so he doesn't have to post a thread in the Card Game DB forums asking why the heck I haven't posted a new episode yet. Well, also, I think I'd like to answer a little listener mail. We had some come in from Matthew Hill, who had, some kind of starter new player rules questions that we answered by email. But he also had a couple questions on a more general deck building and strategy sense that I thought, we could have a good little discussion on.
Sure.
Okay. So, question one, what is the rule of thumb on resource locations in a basic Joust deck? And, related to that, how many limited locations are normally used? The decks posted online seem to be all over the map on this, and I would like to know what a good starting point should be.
I actually was just having this argument with some metamates the other day, but I think the sweet spot for, in general, I'm going to say is 10 to 15. I think where the game is right now, having strong board position early is really key, and so that's the number I strive for, which is a little heavier than I probably did in the past. I pulled up some decks that I've built lately, and it looks like I usually run 3, 5, 6, 7 or 8 of those. The meat and potatoes are repeatable income, so like your gold roads, your sea roads, Kingdom of Shadows, the streets, things you can trigger round after round. Mm-hmm. Usually on top of that I'll toss. In this case, it looks like I'm running 2 C's and 2 coin mints, which are, not necessarily one shot, but boost card. I call them boost incomes, and they're like just kind of that like extra juice to get you over the hill for that one round or make an extra push here or there.
Right.
So that blend is important, but I think somewhere between 10 and 15. Now, obviously, if you're doing something like on a hollow hill, or you've got some other kind of weird way like Dothraki where you can jump dudes in, that can change. But if you're building something fairly straightforward from a functioning standpoint, I would look at 10 to 15.
I was just going to say, so you're saying 10 to 15 income providing locations? Like,
yeah.
We're talking, wow. I think that's on the heavier end.
Well, and there are things that do stuff, like Kingdom of Shadows gives you a dual, you know, you're getting the gold, but you also have this cool standing feature for your shadow stuff.
Yeah.
To give you an example, the deck I'm looking at right now has 3 gold roads, 2 coin mints, a river row, 2 Kingdom of Shadows, 2 Seas, Shadow Black Lane, and Street of Steel.
Right.
Yeah.
That's a deck that I just took to Chicago. So, and it's even got the Arbor Guardsman in here, so there's more income, plus some weapons, some gold weenies.
Right.
So, I mean, income kind of is key. At least when I build, being a Lannister player, resources are everything, and, you know, being able to dominate that is important. But I would say 10, the high side might be 15, but yeah, I would shoot for probably, yeah, 10. I'll
yeah,
say.
I think I'm pretty well on that same page. I have a little more specific of a number for most of my decks, and I shoot for 12 income cards, though that's not always specifically locations. You know, in some decks that can vary for instance, Lannister has a lot of resource weenies available, or Stark has some reducing characters and things like that. Or also, depending on the deck, I may count something that puts characters straight into play, like you mentioned Dothraki, you know. So if I'm looking at my resources, you know, the army that's searching the top of my deck and putting Dothraki straight into play is effectively working like a resource. Though, you know, there is still that caveat that individual decks will definitely vary. Like, my Power Behind the Throne deck has a whole lot more than 12 because it's running a fairly standard suite of about 10 or so income locations of various kinds, and all of the gold weenies, and the heavy taxes attachment. So there's a lot going on there for resources.
Right. Well, I think a part of it, in the way that at least when I'm building like Lannister per se, is going to be how much draw I have in my deck. For me, determines how much income I'm going to put in there, because I have this fear, because it's happened to me too many times where I'm late in the game in a dire situation and I draw into 2 like income cards.
That's actually a really good point.
That, you know what I mean? So like, if I have a lot of draw in the deck, then that means that, you know, I'm going to be able to cycle through it, and so I can afford to put more income in there. If I'm not running a deck with a ton of draw, I'll, you know, honestly, I haven't been huge on the streets here recently, and like the reducers. I actually have a newfound love for the fiefdoms, as weird as that is, but I really like, you know, the gold-producing locations. So I'm okay with running Kingdom of Shadows, even if I only have a couple of Shadows cards, or no Shadows cards. I'm okay with that, depending on the deck. Right now, 3 Kings Roads, either one, pick one, the winter one or the summer one, I put in, like, every deck now. But I'm going to sit around 9 to 10 income locations, and that's in a deck that's not Lannister. Obviously, with Lannister, I'm going to have more. You know, they give you a different way to look at things.
Yeah. You when it's your house is bigger, guys. That affects things.
Right. So, you know, and a part of it is I kind of, you know, a few years ago, kind of started to look at the way that Rings played his games, and he didn't really do a whole lot in terms of locations. And for a while, I once had a deck. Now, granted, I'm not the best deck builder in the world. It was a decent deck at the time, but it was a Greyjoy deck that only ran like 3 locations. It was crazy, but it worked. I mean, it wasn't top tier. Obviously, I've learned since then, but you know, I took that to an extreme level. But you know, it all depends on your deck. But I would say if you're running middle of the road, at least if I'm running middle of the road, I should say, I'm going to sit around 9 or 10. You know, probably closer to that 9. Really, I just don't like to run into income when I could run into something more useful in the later game. So I'm hoping to actively mulligan for income early on.
So you know, I'm kind of curious. Kyle, you mentioned you were having this argument with some of the folks in your meta. What was so controversial in that discussion?
Well, just which kind of resources to run in different builds and talking about the streets and just some, I mean, I wouldn't say, like, I guess I may sound a little more heated than it was. I don't know how intense a discussion about income locations can be, but and just looking at some things, like I was picking apart the deck that won Worlds, is looking at it, and in there they run 3 gold roads and 2 rose roads, and for me, 5 limiteds kind of freaks me out a little bit. And
really? That's interesting, because I was sitting here thinking about Matt's additional question about limited cards, and I think 5 is my upper threshold. I'd say most of the time I'm sticking at 3, you know, 3 copies of, say, the Gold Road or, you know, whatever the in-house limited location may be. But I'm willing to run 5.
Yeah. But I just thought there were better income cards that can be used there, and I don't want to be that guy, but I completely disagree with Daryl on the streets. Like, those things are so good and efficient, and the zero drop is so nice.
I mean,
you can use it that turn. I mean, Martell's Reducer does the same thing. I mean, it's more universal, and it's such a having played Martell for competitively for the first time this past season, just the boost of being able to drop that and go that turn is huge.
Right, but the Martell one, you said yourself, is more versatile, and that's the reason why I haven't been playing the streets, is they're not as universally good as gold.
Well, if you're smart about it, I mean, like the intrigue icon one, especially out of like Lannister, the military one out of Stark and stuff, I think they're very good. And there's something that even me and Ben were talking the other night, Ben from last week, and streets are something that we forget about, and I regret it a lot. I think the biggest change I made to the dragon deck I took to Worlds for Melee was speeding up the income and the location package, and putting in the streets was just that extra jolt of juice you needed to get off the ground running. I think getting off the ground running is a key aspect of the game right now that gets overlooked a lot. Not just key flops, but how does turn one, where are you at end of turn one is the question that I think really needs to be asked long and hard when building a deck, and the streets do so much for that that some of the other income locations don't.
I mean, they do, but man, I have to say I've been erring more and more on the side of gold lately. And I think part of that is because there are so many viable, cheap gold locations now. Of course, for every house, basically, you've got the zero cost, you know, limited ones. But you've also got a nice stable now of non-limited options with the Kingdom of Shadows and now both sets of the King's Roads. And, of course, you've got the in-house chambers for everybody. And Martell's got that Southron Stronghold. And I've really been on that boat lately because... I don't know, is just so much more versatile, and with games tending longer, by and large, aside from Noble Cause games, but, you know, with this reset-heavy stuff, I like having that versatility, and I'm not as worried about needing that immediate payback. You know, if I'm playing, say, that Character Light Bloodthirst deck that I did last week, you know, I'm fine with waiting a few turns, because I want the game to slow down that much anyway.
But think of it this way. So, with, like, the King... Let's go with these King's Roads that Daryl propped up. Now, if you're running the season, I'm all for them. They're great. But if they're not, you're going to pay a card to be down a gold that first round. You're going to spend a gold on something you're going to get no benefit from. The next round, you get 1 gold. So now, it's a round later, and you're neutral on the gold you spent. And the round after that, now 3 turns later, you're finally seeing the fruits of this card that you played 2 turns prior.
Yeah.
Of course, the delay there is you have the initiative going, but the delay there, I mean, as opposed to the street where you drop it and it can be an instant benefit, the street could have saved you 3 gold by the time that King's Road starts to kick in. And like I said, I mean, yeah, games are tending longer, but forcing that turn two valor, getting the upper hand early, games may be lasting longer, but I feel like they're being decided much quicker. Like, people are putting up a fight, and yeah, sometimes they swing it back, but I feel like you have to be strong up front early to succeed.
I think a part of that. Well, I think a part of that can, though, be said is the type of deck that you're playing, though. I think in a more aggressive deck, yeah, I'd probably use the reducers more. But obviously, you can hear by just the way we're talking, we're running more shadow stuff. Those Kingsguard are insane, you know. Those reducers don't work on the Kingsguard. You know, those reducers don't work on shadows cards. So we're gonna use more gold for that.
There is something to be said for that. I've been pretty heavy on the Kingsguard and shadow stuff in general lately.
No, and I get that, and you can use your gold on that, but don't tell me you're not dropping actual characters on top of that. I mean, you just have to be smart about it. I'm not saying run the full suite of River Row and the three icon ones and Street of Silk and Flea Bottom in every deck, but there's a ton of value there that, and you see, I've been looking at a bunch of the tier, like, consensus tier one decks and decks have succeeded, and a lot of them, if not all of them, are running streets, and I think that's not a coincidence.
Right. I mean, I see what you're saying. As far as gaining value out of, you know, paying the one gold for it later, I mean, if there wasn't a taxation phase, then maybe that would be a bigger deal, but in a game where Valor Morghulis decides more games than it doesn't, you know, I don't think that's a huge deal, but you know, it all depends on the structure of your deck, obviously. But yeah, the streets are still good. I've just been leaning away from them here recently.
Yeah, I mean, it's a deck specific thing, just like the overall number of income cards, depending on whether you skew more towards gold or reducers. Just happens to be that the decks I've been playing lately, I feel, are ones that want gold more than reduction.
We can agree to disagree.
All right. Well, if we're just agreeing to disagree, maybe we'll jump on to his next question here. How often should you play more than one copy of any unique character? The initial temptation when I started playing was to DM three copies in to help create situations where I could dupe characters to save them from kill and discard effects. This usually resulted in a bunch of dead cards in my hand after some board attrition or wipe. Is there a generally accepted rule on when to include multiple uniques and when to only run singletons?
Easy answer, in my opinion, would be if that character that you're needing is like a linchpin or is like the backbone of your deck. For instance, Princes of the Sun Red Viper in that classic Martell deck. Or
Cersei in Power Behind the Throne.
Exactly. Or Stannis, the gain every awesome keyword Stannis, you know. I think then you can afford to run more, but you know, it depends on your
Daenerys
deck.
In a classic dragon deck.
Yeah.
Yeah, if they're central, then go ahead and run the triplicates, because the benefit of getting that character ASAP because of your deck design far outweighs the possibility of them being dead later on. And, you know, not coincidentally, I think many of those sorts of characters are ones that either lend themselves to a rush archetype and thus want to end the game before they're dead and gone and you're drawing, you know, useless copies later, or ones with a lot of built-in protection, along with the Princess of the Sun Viper, also Barrack. If you're running, you know, the classic Brotherhood Barrack deck, you're running triplicates of Barrack too.
Yeah, because you want to see him early on.
Mm-hmm.
The one amendment I would make to that is if I'm running a Shadows deck that triggers off of things like being in Shadows, such as like Dragon Pit or whatnot, Neil or Cersei maybe, I might be willing to run some more because you can always throw that dead card into Shadows.
And just leave it there, yeah.
And just leave it there to fuel your Dragon Pit and not have to worry about it, or you know, what
Tunnels
have
of the
you.
Red Keep or whatever.
Yep, exactly. So there are situations where I play with that a little bit, or stuff that's more protected. I'm running, usually two Prestons in a lot of decks these days, just because he's relatively safe. And so you, at that point, I view the two slot as something that you really want to see, but you don't want to see again.
Right.
So
right.
Two ofs, I think, are a much more reasonable answer to your, this unique is really good and I like to catch him. Like in a Shadows deck, I tend to run maybe two Tyrians, just because he's so boss when he's going.
Right.
And you're, the odds of you seeing a second are so much lower than, well, half as when you run threes. So,
yeah,
that's
yeah,
usually the spot I'd look at. If you're drawing to a bunch of dead uniques, dropping it to two and just seeing what that alone does before you, like, swap everything around, is probably a good place to start.
Yeah, it's really a matter of how often do you just need to see this character throughout your game. Like, for instance, Janos Slint, the new one. He's really good, but he's just a character on the board, right? Maybe he can participate in a couple challenges. Maybe he can get you a card, you know, whatever. But in a lot of, in most of the important ways, he's just another body on the board, right?
Yeah.
So you really probably only ever want to see one of him versus, say, Brienne of Tarth that keeps your opponent from playing events while
she's so good.
Yeah. She's really good, and she can help you out of a lot of tight situations, but people are not going to be building the deck around her being on the board for the entire game. So she's a good candidate for having two copies. You want to see her fairly quickly, you know, but odds are not great that you're going to draw into that second copy once she's dead and you're stuck with that card that doesn't do anything versus, you know, like I said, something like Beric where you're playing the Brotherhood deck and, of course, you want three copies of him ASAP because the deck revolves around that.
Yeah. Also, a part of it, I think, is the survivability of that character. You know, how long can they stay on the board and how long can you gain value out of them being on the board as to, you know, before they die or something like that? The first character that comes to my mind is the Spar in a Greyjoy Choke deck. Like, he can be, you know, a card that can be essential to it, or he can be a nice kind of cherry on top. So, like, a lot of times when I build a Greyjoy Choke deck, I put two of them in there. There's definitely people who do three, and there's people who do one. It depends kind of, you know, how you feel that his value is, because, I mean, he's a one-strength dude who has melee, which is awesome, but there's a lot of things that can take him off the board. So I see it as kind of like, he doesn't have crazy survivability, but he is really good in that deck, so I put two instead of three.
Right. You know, and another thought that weighs into things for me is if a character has, like, an Enter's Play ability, I'm probably only going to be running one copy. Like, as good as Sir Aris Okard is, he does most of his work just by me playing that one copy rather than having him on the board for an extended amount of time, you know, which would be what I would be hoping for with a dupe. Or, say, Shadows Varus that discards an ally when he comes out of Shadows. Stuff like that you've already gotten your benefit the instant you play that one copy. I generally only ever run one of.
Yeah.
In uniques, of course. Non-uniques, I'm probably playing triplicates, but...
Yeah. So it's all about the theme. Like, I'm sure in, the majority of Baratheon decks that aren't, you know, the crazy control we're seeing now, well, not control, I should say, like, army recursion stuff, but, like, every Baratheon deck has, like, one copy of Mel. Mel's really good. Well, now there's that Mel that works off of bringing back Holy Crest characters from your dead pile, you know, like that is really good. So if you have a Holy deck, you could possibly put three of her in there. Like, I could totally see that if she's, you know, a central part to bringing those guys out of your dead pile and winning dominance with them in there. So, you know.
Well, I think that sufficiently answered that question. But yeah, I think that was a good talk. And it's just you have to feel it out. I think we kind of expressed that, and it's an art. It's something that takes a lot of time and a lot of playtesting.
Agreed.
Yeah.
All All right. We're also going to return to our now weekly segment here that has been unnamed up till this point on what we've been playing lately. We've had a lot of good suggestions from listeners. You know, I don't want to try and run through all of them and miss somebody that submitted something cool and, you know, cause some bad feelings. So I'm just going to stick with, I think, what we decided earlier tonight is the winner in the end. I think we're going to call this the Painted Table. Has a nice allusion in the book there to Aegon the Conqueror, you know, mapping out all of Westeros and what he's going to do to conquer them, and thought there was a nice connection to us flopping cards on the table.
Yeah.
And so, Mel, and flopping Mel on the table.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. Flopping Mel on the table.
Just tossing her on there like a sack of potatoes.
Wow, way to make that sound really unsexy, Daryl.
Yeah, Daryl, I never want to get seduced by you again.
No,
again,
that doesn't sound...
That one time,
doesn't
more
sound
than
nice. Just all over you like a... Like a wet paper bag just on your body.
I'm never going to have an erection again.
Man, Danny's either going to be really bummed or really excited about that.
Hey,
I'm
now,
sure
there is
which.
One right answer to that question.
Oh, man. Anyways.
So, anyway, yeah, I think Kyle probably has the most interesting news for what he was playing, because he's actually got a full-blown tourney report. You made it up to Chicago, right?
I did. I traveled to the Windy City this weekend and had a good old time. Me and Ben from last week and Danny, who would be heartbroken if I was unable to perform asswads. Made our way up. They had their store tournament at an awesome, I mean, really kick-ass place. It's called Dice Dojo. It's like 6 blocks off the lake.
Oh, cool.
It was a cool store. It was a really, really cool store. The owner was phenomenal. He tossed in like 6 sleeve packs and a play mat as additional prize support.
Like what kind of sleeves? Like some of the FFG sleeves?
Yeah, 2 packs of the Stannis ones, 2 packs of the Robert ones. And I was lucky enough, my consolation prize was they were gray, and they're that, like, the British poster, and it says, Keep Calm and Hodor.
Oh, nice.
And it has the Stark Direwolf where the crown goes. And I was like, those are clever. Yeah, I just tossed them in with a Dice Dojo playmat. And he's like, here's some additional stuff. Kane asked how we're all doing, if there's anything he could do. Great store. If you're ever just up there for business or whatever, I really highly, highly recommend checking it out. I know they play on Tuesdays, so right now they're actually probably playing cards. Well, probably not now. It is 10:40, but earlier they were probably playing cards. But no, it was a great group of guys. I think we had 20 people turn out from 4 different states. I was real happy with it for my first store tournament. You know, I was kind of curious to see what the turnout for these would be. And people care.
I mean,
a lot of people are.
That's pretty good. That's like regional size for the way a lot of regionals have been in the past, right?
Yeah.
And people care. Like, they're really fighting for put on a good tournament so that they can talk about that for these regionals. And then hopefully word gets out. And Doug, the guy, he's kind of their organizer up there, was like, you know, we really want to get the champ on there for an interview beforehand, on another for an interview, and you know, talk about Chicago. And I want to get the word out and get this meta growing. And you know, you can tell that I was a little not. I don't know if I was the biggest fan of this tournament structure, but I think it really is instilling like some energy into the community to step
awesome.
Up for a game. So that was great. On to the games. I ran my. Planning no agenda, a little tweaked from last time, made some changes after how last time went with it in Chicago. And I mean, I just top decked like a mofo all day. I played real well, and the deck kind of performed how you think it would. There were really no issues there. I'm a big believer in, like I said, tons of income, tons of draw, always having resources advantage go your way so you can constantly have a strong board position. The deck's real aggressive. I'll be sure to post it. I mean, you'll see a lot of similarities to some of the other builds that have done well lately. Like, Kingdom of Shadows was a house for me all day. And the funny thing is like, even when I wasn't playing it, people forget about that ability. So I could trigger it off of my opponents.
Oh, totally.
And they wouldn't think about it. And so
were
like,
you
oh.
triggering it, like, more off of their stuff, even?
Yeah, because tons of people are splashing it in now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
With their Kingsguard, and I'm like, that's nice. I tend to win initiative, or, like, I constantly am trying to remember Kingdom of Shadows. I'm thinking about it. So, like, you go big on defense, knowing you can stand someone back up. Stuff like that. And people are like, oh, shoot, yeah, just... I find that right now with where the game is and taking your play to the next level, squeezing every ounce of efficiency and power and those little tiny advantages like that are what snowball into consistent wins. And so that's been something this season I'm trying to really focus on, is getting my game, like, in the details. And so, but yeah, Kingdom of Shadows was real big. I was kind of worried. I wasn't that worried about Cold Hands. I figured I'd see him more than I did.
Oh, wow. So you did not really see him very much.
No, but at the same time, I mean, there's a lot of things in my deck I didn't see all day. I never saw Littlefinger all day. Never saw Tywin all day. I think I only saw the Brigands once, but not important. But people are only running one-ofs of Cold Hands because he's a come-into-play ability, and once he does his thing, you're kind of like, okay, whatever. So people just don't draw them, or there's better plays at the time. I don't run a lot of key characters, so it's hard to pick something to pick up. And I try to control their board, so I'm like, okay, if they play Cold Hands right now, they're out their own quality character, so it's kind of a wash. Or they're spending a gold to put down a Wii, and then spending three for Cold Hands. Now they're out four gold just to put one of my guys down for a monocon. So, yeah, he wasn't as big of an issue as I thought he would be. Let's see. Played the mirror match. Well, I posted general updates on the Facebook page if you want to check them out.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much same song and dance. I had some pretty smooth games. I played the eventual winner in the final round of Swiss, both 4-0, and just got real lucky on some draws. He brought out a Sorrowful Man, and I let, I think it was Oakheart die to it, and triggered my Tyrion. He's running Hollow Hill Burn. Pumped my own Tyrion, then brought out Varys to hit his Sorrowful Man.
Oh, nice.
And he just, like, took away his, like, power icons, and it, there were just a lot of key moments in that game where things broke my way instead of his, and it was just a rout. And that finished that off, so I felt really good. Like I said, I was going 5-0 into Top Cut. Hadn't had a terribly close game. I played Tommy, who was running Power Behind the Throne, which is getting, man, just where the power level is right now, and some of these new cards that are cheap, efficient control. If that deck gets going hot early, it is like a train, and it's hard to stop it.
It'll eat your breakfast and your lunch.
Yeah, so that game, actually, he had an early lead, and I kind of crawled back, and was able to squeak out from him. But other than that, it was pretty solid wins all day. And then kind of the same time I was in same story last time I was in Chicago, I ran into Jesse Shinninninninigan, who I know is out there listening. And he was running Dothraki, and I was worried about it just because of being in Chicago and losing to it last time. And, I mean, the guy just drew the nuts. It seemed like he always had – I hit his income. He didn't really have a lot going for him, and I had set him up for a great Valor at the Iron Throne early, but he just played too many things. Like, he'd lay out the Brady Screamers and not trigger it, so now I just have this big, stupid army to deal with. Or he'd trigger something knowing he's got – and he had a duped Recaro out. So the one that steals power. So it's real hard to be like, okay, well, I'm going to cancel your Vanguard. That's awesome. Now Ricard's going to do his thing twice. Like, a big player mistake that I often see is that when an opponent lays out the Iron Throne, they just go, okay, I'm not going to trigger any abilities. I'm just not going to do it because I don't want to put one of my guys down.
Right.
And that's the wrong way to go about it. You have to flood them with triggers and force them to choose where to what hill to die on. And that's exactly what Jesse did. He handled like a pro. He'd play a Vanguard. I had to choose, okay, I'll cancel this. That's fine. He's got a Screamer out, which is a passive, which blows, and Recaro. So now he's going to steal two power off of his two military challenges, and there's nothing my Iron Throne can do to stop it. He knew I was probably going to Valor, so he laid out Khal Drogo. So now I had to choose, do I Iron Throne the dupe on Recaro to wipe his board, or do I cancel Khal Drogo? He's making me make choices.
Yeah.
And I think as you become a better player, you have to have faith in yourself. You have to make both players make as many ask as many questions as you can of both players and hope that you get more of them right than your opponent does. And that's what Jesse did, and he got more of them right than I did. Tell me afterwards, he felt like he was going to lose that whole game. Just I felt like he just kept drawing exactly what he needed to just be just one step ahead of me, and I couldn't get ahead of him. And that's just kind of the way it goes. That's one of those decks that, I mean, that's the appeal. When it fires and when it hits, it's just a sea of beef, and it's hard to counteract that. It doesn't matter how much control you're running.
And I mean, I could stall like Kyle I did Cersei Steam's
turn where I essentially knelt out of his board before I did challenges. I do. Big ol' sea of beef. But, like, I mean, you can stall him with, like, your City of Sin plot. You can stall him with Cersei Schemes, but, like, it just keeps standing back up, and it's going to do it again the next round, and just delaying the inevitable. So, I mean, kudos to him. He played a great game, real tight. I didn't see any play mistakes. And so, yeah, once again, I fall to the Horde. And unfortunately, I didn't get to stick around as long as I'd like to, because it was Sunday, and it was a long drive back to Iowa for us. But it was a really good tournament, solid play, top up to bottom. Great store, great meta. Really hope to get up there some more and see what's brewing in Chicago.
Cool.
Yeah, awesome. I'm glad you had a great time, and look forward to getting to play with those guys some more. I've gotten to play with a few of them that came down. I think it was for last year's Moon Boy, so they're good guys.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they're starting to travel more and really, really get into it. And there's some old staples up there. Brian Bleers has been playing for a long time. That's the name that comes to mind. I'm sure there's more.
All right, so that was a good tourney report. I guess we're going to move on to mine and Will's... how do I say it? Like, my painted table choice? I don't know how I'm supposed to put that.
I think we can just go with our decks. I think we're just calling the segment as a whole the painted table.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's a good idea. Okay. So I was just kind of sitting around and just had the idea of playing a revisited version of the House of Pain deck that John Bruno won the 2012 Joust Championship with. Now, obviously, there have been some restrictions since then and things like that to where I couldn't build it up as is, but I definitely did some changes that I thought would be pretty neat. Nothing insane. Like I added like an additional to be a dragon and an extra company of the cat and something else, like just a an added card to replace the street waif. So I added Danny's Chambers to it too, because and some dragon skulls. So I did actually change a lot.
Oh, I didn't see the dragon skulls.
Yeah, and they worked pretty well. Now, granted, the one game I got to play that day with it, because we just have been in the habit of running a number of different decks, just having fun. But I played against a Bera, see who is stronger deck that just recurred everything, and I even rebuilt the plot deck, so I was even rolling with Waste Their Time as just kind of a fun play, I get to do this, get to shuffle that bitch back in, and it really didn't do anything against him, and I was holding him off slowly, killing some things, but whenever you pop in two Vipers Bannermen and your recurring C was stronger out the ass and stuff. Like, it's just a matter of time. So, but I was overall happy with the deck, though. Like, that deck is still a lot of fun to play. And I mean, that's, you know, Targ, Knights of the Hollow Hill. I mean, it's still good. It's still fun. You're still burning the world around them down to the ground. So that is what I've been playing here recently.
Well, I actually, like you said there, bounced around through several different decks on Saturday because I was trying to test a few extras that I was going to have set up for folks that are coming to Moon Boy that maybe don't play as regularly, like Josh Staten or possibly Fox if he does make it down, and, you know, just any of our sometimes players. So I tweaked a version of the Maesters Behind the Throne a little bit more, threw in like the new zero cost Clegane guys. Still probably need to tweak the plot deck a little bit more. I had forgotten that the last version of the deck, actually, which had been loaned to Fox last time it was played, had actually dropped Art of Seduction in favor of some other stuff. I think, if I remember right, its own Valor was that last swap we'd made, along with some other stuff, Cersei Schemes and whatnot. So when I tweaked it, I forgot to change any of the plots until I sat down to play it and realized they needed fixed. It's still a fairly fun deck, though. I think maybe as competitive as it ever was, which was probably not tier one, but maybe one and a half.
I rolled you with it?
Yeah, well, there is that. You know, the year that we were both playing Power Behind the Throne, and then told in the last round of Swiss that whichever one of us won the game would make the cut, and then you won, and neither of us made the cut.
Kyle wrecked my ass in that tournament.
That Maester's deck was hot. I ran that. That thing was on fire.
That was good. That was definitely part of what inspired my turn on it. Though I'm not filling with out of house stuff like Lewin that like you were, or like the Ravens. I think I was also partly inspired by the old classic Rush portion of the Martell Maesters. That was what I was wanting to try and emulate. But yeah, it's still a solid deck.
Nice.
Yeah. I mean, aside from that, I got a couple other games in. Did put together a Stark Knights of the Realm deck with the Kingsguard. And, you know, I really dig that. I think those Shadows Kingsguard give it more staying power and more resiliency than it had before. So that's definitely nice. You still got a lot of uniques for... the event that I always mess up. I always want to call it Die by the Sword, but that's the Warcrest event. What's the Stark one, Daryl?
No Quarter.
Yeah, thank you. And that sort of thing. So that played fairly well, though it was its first game. So it could probably stand to be tweaked. And then, just for giggles, I put together a House of Dreams Clansman deck using...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Using the Inn at the Crossroads as my House of Dreams, and that dream of being a giant golden pile to sit on every turn. And, you know, it actually played pretty well. I had a hard time cutting that one down. It is 60 cards, but I definitely had to cut some self-discarding and recurring themes that I wanted to fit in it originally. And fiddle around with some stuff. So I think it definitely needs tweaked up. But it was almost surprisingly fun to play. There's something nice about getting plus, you know, 3-4 gold or whatever just out of that one location that is a really gratifying feeling.
Yeah.
And I will say, in that deck, I feel like maybe I made the wrong choice for restricted cards. I went with... the Mountain Refugee, you know, for setup, which is nice with House of Dreams, and, of course, it's a nice cheap clansmen to give me more gold with the inn. Works nicely with Chella and whatnot. But the more I think about it, and the fact that if your opponent, you know, resets the board, they wipe out your resource base as well as your characters, I think Narrow Escape is actually probably the right call. Yeah.
Yeah. Also, in that game, right, that you only played one game with that deck, I think?
Yeah, yeah. Only...
But you got the... Did you mention... No, I don't think you did.
You're right. No, I didn't.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, yeah. I got No Kneeling, not No Kneeling, I guess. Doesn't kneel to attack Tywin. That is, as long as they have more cards in hand, running with two painted dogs. So he was actually a 12-strength Tricon that wasn't kneeling to attack, and that pretty well owns the challenge phase. And, of course, I was also going first, so he was available to defend one challenge at 12-strength as well. So that was pretty sweet.
Yeah, that's insane.
Yeah. And thinking it, I mean, he's still really fragile because he doesn't have any built-in protections, but it was fun to do.
Painted dogs are real strong. I'm using them a lot more frequently now than I did even when they first came out. I think that pump, even when now, especially if you can play it down to the +4, is just really, really good.
If you can hit that +4, I mean... One of the big things about those Brightwater Man-at-Arms is that they're a 2-for-4, right? And if you have less cards in hand, that's essentially what those Painted Dogs are doing, as long as you've got another character to boost. I mean, you know, just similar idea as far as impact on the board.
Yeah.
But those guys, plus like a Huber Hill, you can just take whatever you want. Like, let throw things in their discard pile, because they're just joining your side.
Yeah. Yep.
And, you know, switching gears slightly back to that start deck, because I'm thinking about protection on characters. You know, there is a start card that I really kind of wanted to throw out some praise to, because I think it's still kind of undervalued, even in the current meta, and that is totally the Crown of Winter.
Oh, hell yeah.
Yeah, like, I had some bad times in that game, where, you know, I had the Blackfish in my hand and I had the Crown of Winter in my hand and I played it and it immediately got bounced with House Divided before I could take my next action to play the Crown. So I was like, well, crap. All right. Next turn, I'll do it for sure. Play the Blackfish and immediately bounced again to House Divided. So I wound up giving up on that plan. And I just played it elsewhere. You know, I played the Crown on Edmure, actually, in that game. And it still turned Edmure into a beast. I mean, like you mentioned, Daryl, it effectively turns the character it's on into the Red Viper. Or at least, you know, some of the more pertinent parts of the Viper, which is the friggin' boss immunities.
Yeah.
You know, the +2 strength is nothing to sneeze at. Winter can really affect things in some games. Turns on some nice Stark effects. Turns on, you know, the King's Roads if you're running those, which I am in that deck. You know, it's a unique attachment, so it's immune to Dragon Thief. I think it's just got a lot going for it right now.
Yeah, it's, you know, after the fall of the Ten Link, you know, we all started to kind of rediscover these attachments, because there was such a long time there, and there's still times where you'll build a Thrones deck and not put a single attachment in there. We just got in that habit of just like, they're too frail, you know, and whatnot. But man, some of those attachments out there have some real true value, and in the right deck, that attachment's fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm starting to see at least a Widow's Wail in almost every Lannister build.
Hell yeah.
Agreed.
Yep.
And I never would have done that a year or two ago, ever.
Oh, yeah, absolutely not. And I mean, there's still effects out there, obviously, that'll get rid of those attachments. And, you know, if you don't have a way to save the character, you just got 2-for-1 or something, you know. But, you know, we're definitely starting to see some of those good attachments being played again. It's pretty nice.
I agree.
With me here, we have Andy Ritt, the Chicago store champion.
All right. So for the Chicago meta, it used to be pretty scattered across the region. I didn't start playing until about a year and a half ago. An old buddy of mine got me involved in the game, and when I started, it was only one group out in the suburbs I knew played the game. But as I started to branch out online to meet new people, I found several groups that were playing downtown Chicago, and eventually we all ended up at Dice Dojo, where we held the recent store championship.
I've heard good things about that place.
It's phenomenal, and they're in really good with FFG as well. They've held several events for their other games, Netrunner and Star Wars in particular, and we're starting to build out the Game of Thrones at their store, which is, they've been amazing so far. And I would describe our meta as pretty much all new people to card games for the most part. My background is I played Magic the Gathering growing up, and then, as most people did, took the break when I went to college, and it wasn't until I started playing Game of Thrones that I started playing any competitive game again. But I was pretty serious in the Magic. A lot of Pro Tour events.
Oh, really?
Very competitive back in the day. So
I had no idea.
Yeah, it's kind of easy slipping back into the groove again with Game of Thrones. And I would also describe our meta as aggro heavy in terms of the Game of Thrones deck types.
So a little different from what we're seeing or hearing that we're seeing, you know, in the meta at large then.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm definitely the control guy in our meta. I played my first real competitive tournament for Game of Thrones was Gen Con last year. I took Targ Hollow Hill to that as well. And I played Targ again in our store championship recently. Much different deck, though, with probably 30 cards or so different than my Gen Con deck.
Oh, yeah, that's basically a brand new deck, really, once you account for, you know, a few staples and whatnot. Changing half the deck then is way different.
Yeah, different restricted, and then just a whole different event base and much more. I even turned my deck a little aggro heavy. But even people that are playing Lannister No Agenda, they're very focused on aggro. Some people, depending on matchups, they'll turn it into a bit more of a control deck, and everyone here plays pretty aggressive, pretty aggro-centric. So that's both good and bad. I like to be able to play test against a broader range, and my presence on Octagon isn't very big, so most of my play testing occurs against these guys. But I was really impressed. We were able to get 20 people into the store for the store championship, pulled a few people in from neighboring states and metas, and it was a pretty good representation across the field of houses and deck types.
Gotcha. Yeah, I think I'd heard 4 states, maybe?
Yeah, that sounds right. And one of the things I really prefer to Game of Thrones compared to Magic is just the people. It's even in a competitive atmosphere, you couldn't be in a friendlier place.
Yeah, I've only ever done Magic casually rather than competitively. Maybe a pre-release or something. So I'm sure the PTQ type world is way different.
It is. And even when I played a few games of Magic recently, and even just playing a fun booster draft at a store, you're still running across people who take themselves far too seriously. So I really just, I appreciate that probably more than anything else about the game are the people I'm meeting through it. And Magic I played for many, many more years, and I've already made more friends through Game of Thrones than I have ever played playing Magic.
That's awesome. Yeah, there's just something about that generally more mature group that tends to play Thrones that is generally just really welcoming.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree with you on that. And it helps that we also have a couple of really strong people who are guiding the meta right now. Doug Pearson in specific, he's really been doing a great job of helping to grow and not just grow the meta in Chicago, but also build up our presence at Dice Dojo, the store we've been playing at, to help them support, adding additional prize support on top of what FFG provides, even at the store championship level was really great of them. They provided, you know, additional play mats and other gear that we were able to hand out. And just that kind of support from them, you know, also helps draw people to the store and our group.
Well, you know, you mentioned a moment ago that your deck for the store championship was pretty radically different there. I'm a little curious, could you walk us through some of the things that prompted you to take it in this different direction and how you wound up there? Was there a particular place in your local metagame that you were, you know, shooting to take advantage of? Or was it just to meld it more to your personal play preference? Or what kind of happened there?
There's a couple of key pieces I went into. And going back to my Gen Con experience, I know the meta has changed quite a bit since that tournament, but that was the last real good broad competition I got playing a Targ deck, and taking notes from that play experience, regardless of how the meta changes, there's still the same archetypes out there, and figuring out how to build against those has always been one of my focuses. So with this deck, I wanted to focus on putting more pressure on my opponent and not simply being reactive. So my deck was much less event heavy. I was only running about 12 or 13 events in my Targ Hollow Hill deck, which is pretty light compared to some. And really the MVPs of the day were my two claim plots, and I wanted to take as much advantage of those as I possibly could. And that was one of my driving forces behind the deck.
How many of the two claimers were you running?
Well, Dry Season, which is definitely one of my top three MVPs of the deck, is one of them, and the other one is Meta Pride. So just two, but those two turns are where I'm either targeting just to take absolute control of the board, or really damage their hand and take control through that way. And doing that, putting that kind of pressure on my opponent in a control deck, you know, even if I just remove, you know, one extra character out of their hand or take one extra character off the board, that gives me more options on how to play my hand in future turns, because I didn't have to use something to do that work for me. So just in the meta as a whole, I value two claim plots just extremely high. So although I'm passing up on some interesting and useful effects from other plots, I've found that easy to add card advantage to be huge right now. The other MVP in my deck, taking up one of the all valuable event slots, was Nightmares All Day Long.
I think that's a pretty strong staple for a lot of folks now.
It's just an unstoppable card. I know a lot of people that look at that and it ends up being a last cut in their deck, or maybe they only find the room for one copy, but I'm pretty vehemently supportive of two copies in most of my decks right now.
Okay, so you were playing two rather than the full playset?
Yeah, I was running just two in this one. Partly because, again, knowing the meta, I know that there wasn't a ton out there that I needed to blink in the decks. And Lanny, no agenda. It's not as much of a silver bullet for me. I've got several other cards doing work for me against that deck. But yeah, when you need it, it's just a nigh unbeatable card.
If I might derail slightly, me using the term playset, you know, just made me think about your Magic background. Since you can play four of a card in Magic and only three of in Thrones, I'm curious, you know, did that transition, even with a few years in between, feel strange? Was it tough to kind of work out some of the different ratios there, or was that all pretty smooth?
Honestly, it's actually interesting you're bringing that up, too, because when I was first transitioning to Thrones, it took me a while to to wrap my head around the rule systems in Thrones and the ratios in Thrones, and just the fact that you can draw two cards a turn in Thrones really changes the way you approach deck building. And now that I've been playing Thrones almost exclusively for about a year and a half, I would be thrown off if I went back to Magic now. Even though I played Magic for 10 years of my life, or however long it was, I couldn't. It would be an adjustment period to go back to Magic now.
I play off and on MTGO. I play some Popper on there, and it feels slow as a dog to go back to drawing one card a turn.
I don't blame you.
Okay, well, any other things of note then? In say the draw deck that kind of touched on some of the keys of what you thought about the plot deck, but I don't know too much about that draw deck yet.
Yeah, I everything for me when I'm starting to build this deck is Company of the Cat is really what made me switch to Targ as my go-to tournament build. I think that card is just one of the strongest cards out there, especially when I'm wanting to push through two claim challenges on the all-important military and intrigue, when I'm trying to establish control, that four strength, able to replace itself, card that you can ambush into play is just, it's just unreal. So, you know, when I'm looking at top three cards in my draw deck, that definitely slots in there. And when I built my Gen Con deck, I also built it as more of a recursion deck, just focusing on Street Waves and Ambush from the Plains, recruitments, etc., really maximizing the effect of Company of the Cat with those cards.
Okay.
And it was a little different than what most Targ decks were at that time as well. And the one thing I still haven't solved with that version or this version is a real hard Greyjoy cancel deck. That deck is the one that will still give mine problems. And the only cancels I'm currently running in my version are two Hand's Judgments. And when I was looking at the deck after the tournament, the only changes I would make, probably three card change. I'd probably run up to a third copy of the Red Keep. And I would probably find room for two more cancels. Whether that's a third Hand's Judgment or a couple of paper shields, I'd probably look to find room for that in the deck.
You know, it's interesting you bring up the Hand's Judgment because, a lot of folks may not think of it, obviously, right off the bat, but it feels like it actually has a pretty strong home in Targaryen, particularly something using these ambush cards and such. Because you can use the influence to get cards like the Company of the Cat into play and safely sit on your gold without having to spend it on those characters, and then you've got it available to cancel something with Hand's Judgment.
Yeah, exactly. It fits perfectly into what Targ's trying to do with its resource curve. And, you know, it's a couple times now being able to Hand's Judgment someone else's Hand's Judgment has been invaluable. Like, it's just, it's one of those things they don't necessarily see coming. They think they have you right where they want you, and it's just perfect at that time. It's one of those cards that fits perfectly into the deck, and it's one of those where whenever I had it, I'm glad I did, and there were a couple times I wish I did. So I would definitely look to get a couple more cancels into the deck. But I would say that for my deck, it was pretty smooth sailing for most of the day. I played against a Bear Recursion deck in the first round. I'm not going to go into too much detail through the rounds because I know Kyle already provided some feedback, but I faced a Bear Recursion, a Lanny Wildling, Bear Knights of the Realm twice, once in the Swiss, once in the top eight. One of the decks that my deck is really designed, not on purpose, to kill is the Viserys House of Dreams Pentos deck.
That really? Deck, tell
that
me
deck
more.
Is just the scariest thing I've seen in a while. I fear that more than any other deck right now. And my deck has March to the Wall is a silver bullet against that deck. Mm-hmm. And threat from the north also hurts that deck quite a bit. They do have several attachments that pump, but if they don't have those at the time, or you can will down, then that's a huge card. But when I played that opponent in the fourth round of the Swiss, I killed Viserys twice, and they still had a one play and got it to be within 5 power of victory after only 4 plots before I was able to win. The fact that they can reload a third Viserys by the fourth plot and still get up to 10 power is, it just makes it a very frightening deck to play against. No matter how many times you think you knock them down, it's able to pick itself right back up with its plot card draw and its attachment card draw. But between March the Wall, Rally Cry for their Pentos, Threat from the North, and my attachment control, it's just a really bad matchup for that deck. And March the Wall is just another card of mine that it's just an MVP of any control deck. I won't even start a control deck without putting that in as my first plot. And then I played Kyle in the fifth Swiss round. Mm-hmm. And he was my one loss of the day, and not to take anything away from people, but it was really my only close game of the day at all.
Wow.
And I'd never played against Kyle. The one other time he was at the Chicago store for a tournament, I was not able to attend. So I definitely played, I'm going to give him credit, I absolutely did not throw the game in any way, shape, or form, but I was fully expecting to play him again in the finals. Mm-hmm. And I played a little differently just to see how things would go and set myself up for a rematch, and try to take him a little bit more by surprise. And he just torched me with Shadows Tyrion. That's one of those cards against the Hollow Hill Targ deck that you have to, even if they only have one copy in the deck, you have to always plan that they'll draw into it and know how to deal with it. And that was one of the things I really took away from my Gen Con experience is appreciating what every deck's silver bullets against you are and always preparing for those.
Planning for the worst. You know,
exactly.
I'm sure decks in Game of Thrones can come up with those answers considerably easier than a lot of Magic decks can.
Yeah, Magic, especially when the online deck building sites came into being. You know, I started playing before that online presence was really in any sort of card game. And once that came into being, Magic really turned into much more of a rock, paper, scissors kind of game. And you knew the kind of decks, the specific kind of decks that were out there. There was very little variance. And in Game of Thrones, you know, as the environment matures, you start to develop that understanding of decks. But there's still much more variance in this game than I would say there is in Magic. And lost in the top 8 at Gen Con, had the game in full control, and he drew into his one Baylor Black Tide, and I didn't have the answer that I should have had. I played too loose when I was in control, and I didn't take that card into account. Lesson learned, and build on it.
I mean, I guess that's really the only way to get better is run into those situations and then have the idea of how to account for it the next time.
Right. And that's understanding the card pool can't be understated enough. I mean, that's half the battle. One of the guys I play with, I got into Game of Thrones. He's a really good Magic player. And his biggest problem is not knowing the card pool well enough. And that's what gets him into trouble in every game he plays, basically. And then I also played against a Dothraki No Agenda deck, which has been pretty popular in Chicago lately. Obviously, it has a pretty decent matchup against the Lanny No Agendas that are running around out there.
Definitely.
but a combination of me being able to use my control cards on the lower strength characters and then pushing through the two claim challenges to remove their larger threats makes that a pretty good matchup for my deck as well. And then I played against another Landing No Agenda deck in the finals, and that one was rough. And by the end of the second turn, he had one card in hand, I believe, and zero cards in play.
Oof.
So it's, when the deck clicks, it clicks. The other card that I know there's a lot of talk right now on the new FAQ and what should or shouldn't be restricted. And I'm obviously hoping Knights of the Hell Hill is not restricted.
Yeah.
But I do think that there's a couple of good options to get rid of that open things up a bit more in favorable ground, which was huge for me all day.
Yeah, as soon as you said you were running, now my brain shut down, the location blanking plot, I figured you must have been running favorable ground.
Yeah, absolutely. That combination is what helped me clear the final Lannister's board that last turn, blowing up a couple limited locations and Golden Tooth Mines and Pentoshi, and that sets them back quite a bit, I would say.
Most certainly. Yeah, a lot of their power is in having that kind of overwhelming location base.
Exactly. But all around, it's a deck I wouldn't make many tweaks to, given the current FAQ. And I'm honestly surprised I haven't seen it be more successful out of Targ in the major tournaments. I know it's producing top 16 results, but I didn't see much, you know, top four, and that's something that definitely surprised me.
Yeah, any thoughts on what might be causing that in the end, or feel like it's a little bit of a fluke?
Yeah, I have to assume it's more of a fluke, but at the same time, looking at the deck lists that do go up for those top 16s, I would definitely say my deck is quite a bit different than those. I think that comes back to our meta being a little more aggro focused, even for a control deck.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of those I see, you know, minimum 18 events, 20 events in a lot of those, and I prefer to be able to put some pressure on my opponent and not just be reactive to what they're doing, especially against certain matchups like the Viserys matchup, where if you can't put pressure on them every turn and build up power, it can bounce back and get you if you're not able to do anything to them. But yeah, like I said, I don't think there's many things I would change. If there was, you know, if Worlds was tomorrow, I'd probably play this deck with just a couple tweaks I discussed. I think because of the city plots being so prevalent and location hate being so prevalent in general right now, Red Keep I would go up to three of. I think that's a must in this deck type right now.
Gotcha. Yeah. Seems like there's a good bit of that location 8 floating around at the moment.
I mean, especially against the Landing No Agenda matchup. You know, it was one of the things, too, like from Kyle's matchup, I wanted to see how he would react. I had an influence providing location of play and Meraxes in play. Mm-hmm. A lot of players would target the Meraxes.
Definitely.
Kyle targeted the influence provider. So, you know, it helps to get that kind of information with your opponent and see how they play and understand the game, and that was you know, one of those things where you have to file it away and know how to play against that the next time you see them.
Yeah, and you know, and that's a really good note as far as not only understanding what generally happens, you know, in a particular situation like that, but in specific knowing what that opponent is likely to do if, say, one of them bucks that trend a little bit. Because I would agree that most players are going to want to cut off your draw and go after Meraxes instead.
Right. Yeah, it's draw and generally dominance win, and most people would target that first and the correct play there against the Targ deck, obviously unless the board's flooded with influence, is to go after that influence.
Yeah, totally strangled that out. Actually, I had a fun game at Gen Con against K-Tom, who was playing kind of this janky Greyjoy deck using the, I believe it's the Orcmont Raiders, is it? The No Agenda Army.
Yeah.
That lets you, you know, strip cards out of the top of the deck. And he actually dominated my Targ Knights of the Hollow Hill because he used them to strip out all my influence. I didn't draw any influence past the agenda until turn, like, six or something.
That's brutal.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, it worked out pretty well if you know exactly what it is you need to strip out because you're familiar with those other archetypes.
Right. And that's the other thing, too. And I try to also, you know, work with people in the store as well to help them understand thought process behind certain deck building strategies and the like, because like I said, a lot of people are new to card games in our meta.
Mm-hmm.
And I've definitely built up a pretty strong knowledge storage of knowledge by my years of playing Magic competitively, and knowing those key cards and being able to just file some stuff away as auto moves when, you know, when I'm looking at my initial draw, do I mulligan or not?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I know I have, you know, three silver bullets against that, you know, against Lanny No Agenda in my deck. Do I have any of those in my hand? No. Okay, do I have a good base of influence in my hand? No. Then 95-99% of the time I'm mulliganing. And then you have that same storage of knowledge for every type of deck that you sit down and play across from.
Yeah, it's a lot like, did you happen to catch the episode we did, and actually it was based on a Magic the Gathering article I was reading on shortcutting?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, and that's totally what you're talking about there.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite episodes of your guys, because it hit on a huge point, and I would recommend you guys, before any major tournament that comes up, I think you guys should repost that or link to it, because that's 101 right there, especially when you're playing for 8 hours in a day or more. You need to have those in place.
Yeah, yeah, that really takes off a lot of the mental wear and tear, because sitting through a, you know, 5-6 round Swiss tournament, you know, the mental gears start winding down towards the end, and if you can lighten that load some, it's only a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely. That was actually one of the things I underestimated from my Gen Con experience, because it had been so long since I played competitively for a length of time. When I got into that top 16, I couldn't even imagine playing another game. And I had to definitely recharge the batteries to get refocused.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a lot of, I think that's something that people first time don't fully appreciate.
Well, I think we're probably getting close to our time for the moment, but any last parting thought or tip there, Andy?
One thing I would say is if you're listening to the show, keep listening. It's the best Game of Thrones podcast out there.
Hey, thanks.
And it's definitely something I listen to while I'm eating lunch at work most of the times, and gets me through the day. And I would say I'm really looking forward to the new cycle and the new FAQ. Really surprised the new FAQ didn't drop a 4-star championships, but I think it'll make the regional season more interesting, assuming it comes out before then.
Yeah, I'm sure it will. I was also a little surprised, but my guess now is they wanted to get a little more data under their belts with this cycle wrapped up before they shook things up too much, so we'll see. I'm sure the ball is way up in the air on what's going to happen.
Absolutely. All right. Well, I appreciate you having me on the show.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming on, Andy. And there you have it, listeners, the Chicago store champion over at Dice Dojo.
Thank you.
We propping and slopping?
I think we are.
All right, Kyle, give us a prop and or a slop.
Prop and or slop. The slop has to be that I just learned that this is the snowiest winter this area has had in the last 50 years. And I know I think I slop the weather every week, but really the snow can go. Whenever it wants, it can go.
Yeah, right. I hear you guys just keep getting more up there.
We just got 6 inches this past weekend, and I'm just ready for it to be done.
Yeah.
Especially since it's so little, I'm membering 2 cars every week, every time it snows.
Ooh.
Yeah, the movies make snow look like glamorous and inviting and fun, and the truth is, it sucks. It's dangerous. People drive like garbage. You got to go out to your car and scrape it down, and you know it's cold as balls whenever you sit in your car. And like, snow sucks.
I don't mind it. Just 2 months of it nonstop has been a little rough. And my prop would be, you know, just Chicago as a whole was great. There's this little burger joint called the Burger Philosophy down the way from this car shop, and they recommended it, so me and Ben checked it out, and I got this big kick-ass burger on like a pretzel bun with bacon on it, and then
ooh, tasty
blue cheese covered french fries, and I was like this seems weird, but oh, they're so good.
Yeah, that sounds hot.
That's a nice thing I like about whenever I travel, I try to eat things I could never have in the Quad Cities or in Iowa City. So I look for things that are unique to the area, try out the local fare. I cannot wait to get down and hit up the bar with you guys. That dive has some of the best bar food I've had anywhere.
Oh, it really does.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
So I look forward to that, but that's something I'd like to do, and Chicago certainly never disappoints. So between that and the deep dish, again, just a great time.
Yeah, I need to have some real Chicago pizza sometimes. The Chicago-style places here are good and all, but I'm sure it's just not the same.
It's not. We had some with roast beef this time. I've never seen that as an option, but we like tried it. We just seen it. It was actually really, really good. It was a nice change-up.
Hmm. Nice. Will, you got one?
You know, I'm going to give myself some props/slops. Props for finding my copy of Dangerous Women so I could continue reading that anthology. Slops for me burying it in clothes that I've taken off. You know, dress shirt I wore to work and then took off and threw in a chair nearby me, or you know, the jacket and scarf I wore one day and throwing it over the chair. And yeah, so I finally cleared all that stuff back off, and hey, there's the book I thought I lost. Go figure.
Nice. Well, I've got a prop. I finished Full Moon, so the second Dresden novel. It was good. It wasn't crazy, and like, you know, after I had posted on my Facebook that, you know, I finished and stuff, a lot of people were chiming in and just like, well, it gets way better. The third novel's when things really get, you know, kicked off and things like that, which is awesome. I mean, there's like 13 Dresden novels or something, so I will get around to reading the rest, I'm sure, because they're super easy and quick reads too, so it's pretty cool. So now I am reading a book called Snow Crash by Neal Stephenson that I had picked up, I want to say almost a year ago, and I had read the first few chapters, and just like so many other books, I just stopped reading, so I'm going to finish it as my next book and see how that goes. So I don't know, that's sort of a prop-ish type thing, so... Will, you got another one?
You know, boy, I have not done much else lately, gotten to see any movies or anything like that, but I have been watching the Winter Olympics in Sochi. Mm-hmm. Despite the kind of debacle that a lot of the Russian stuff has been, the actual events themselves have been pretty sweet, and you know, I certainly don't follow these winter sports at any other time, but there's always something cool and exciting about watching the Olympics, I think. So I've gotten into stuff like, I don't even remember the name of this skiing event, like Super G or something like that, like,
oh,
that
yeah.
I've never heard of before. But I happened to turn on the Olympics in time to watch Bodie Miller come down and, you know, post the at that moment the best time, and he's in first. And of course, there's still a half a dozen or so competitors after him, and you know, they're saying, you know, it's an okay time, but not great. He's probably not going to hold on to it. And, you know, the next guy comes down, they're like, oh, well, this was last year's, like, World Cup champ. He might just beat it. And then he comes down, and he's quite a bit slower. And I'm like, yes, all right, he won. He held on. And then the next guy, they're like, this is the one that won gold in the 2010 Winter Olympics. He comes down, and he's slower and stuff. And I'm like, holy crap. Like, I know nothing about this sport, but it's exciting, like, seeing if you can hang on to this lead. And there's just been a lot of cool things like that that I don't know or follow, but suddenly I look at the TV and I'm like, holy crap, the Netherlands or whatever blew out this speed skating competition because they've got the gold, silver, and bronze. Badass.
Yeah. Every time the Olympics comes around and curling is on, I remember how much I enjoy watching curling.
It's a crazy sport.
Yeah, whenever you, like, explain curling to someone, they're like, that sounds stupid. But then if you're in there and you're watching it, you know, it's on TV, everyone suddenly pays more and more attention to it, and you're like, this is actually very entertaining. Like, I don't know what it is about curling, but something to do with the brooms, maybe, I don't know.
Yeah, definitely brooms, sorry.
Definitely brum. Anyways, yeah. I got another prop. I don't know if I propped it in the last episode, but I'm going to prop it again. I picked up the 3DS game Bravely Default. I did prop it, now I remember. But that game has still been very, very good. You know, I don't play games as much as I used to, but I've definitely found about an hour before bed every night or every other night to play this game. And it's been super fun. Very, like, reminds me of, like, the earlier Final Fantasy games and, like, the job system and stuff. So if you have a 3DS,
that's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's super fun. And, like, you can, I'm sure I talked about it all in the last episode, but regardless, you can like, turn up and turn down your random encounters. So if you don't want to go through a lot of random encounters at the time, like, you know, you just want to go to town and buy some stuff, you can turn them all the way off. And so you're not going to get in any battles. Or if you need to, you know, sit there for a grinding session, you can turn it up and you can do, you know, what used to take you hours and hours and hours, only like 15 minutes. Because you can also up the speed of the battle, like mid-battle, like it's the press of the button on the D-pad just to increase the speed so you can, like, do your grinding and stuff. Yeah, it's really an awesome way to cater to, you know, those of us that grew up with those cool JRPGs, but, you know, we do things now. We, you know, we have responsibilities, and we don't have enough time to really sit there and, you know, spend 12 hours playing a game, you know, so it's fantastic.
Yeah, that sounds really rad. Like, the stuff you'd said before already made me kind of excited about it, but, like, the two of those together really makes it seem like they thought about people in our sort of position, so, yeah.
Yeah, it's great. Great for adults. So, Bravely Default, and I think that's, oh, geez, I feel like I'm forgetting, like, a prop, like, something awesome happened, I totally forgot. Oh, well, who gives a shit? No one's listening at this point anyways.
Yeah, they always turn us off.
It's just me and you, buddy.
Just me and you. Actually, you know, that is worth pointing out. Kyle is not with us at the moment because he had some internet difficulties. Plus, he has to get up quite early in the morning for work, and I know there have been a comment or two in a previous episode that he kind of just suddenly disappeared. So it kind of seems to be a regular thing. His internet seems to give out after we've been on Skype for an hour and a half or so. Yeah. So just don't be too surprised if in the future Kyle is not around for props and slops other times.
Yeah. It's just the way it works.
Though that also means, evidently, somebody was listening to Props and Slops.
Yep. Kudos to you. One of these days, we're going to start giving out prizes during Props and Slops or something, like some kind of, you know, secret. We're going to give you some kind of secret code during Props and Slops that you can send us, and the first person to send it to us will get a prize or something. I don't know. I'm not a doctor.
Thank
you know what I do know?
Smoking did not kill that hooker.
That's right. Danger zone!
Yeah, I'm starting to feel the ego swell. I don't know how many episodes it's been, but it's hard putting my helmet on when I get on the bus.
Oh, man. If that bus were any shorter, you wouldn't fit.
That's because of my long dong, Will. That has nothing to do with my helmet. As Daryl knows, it takes a special kind of vehicle to take a huge penis with you out
yes.
to the world.
Preferably yes. a stretch limousine.
It does. It does. I actually have to, my dong stays on a space station on the moon, and whenever it's ready for use, I have to have it teleported here. So
you're walking around dickless? Did you just say that?
I mean,
you just walk around.
Listen, man.
Like Barbie.
I don't conceal and carry, okay?
But that's right? legal in Missouri.
That's true. But, you know, I wouldn't want to whip it out and, you know, poke somebody's eye out or something.
I think he likes being a Ken style down there. The flat plastic front's real nice.
Yeah, I don't want to intimidate anyone.
Wow. This intro went into a really disturbing direction I did not expect.
That tailspin was impressive.
Yeah.